Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Renee Firestone. She'll give her recollections of being imprisoned at age 19 for 13 months in the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp during the last years of World War II. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, May 3, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum.
A native of Czechoslovakia, Firestone was imprisoned at age 20 for 13 months in the infamous concentration and extermination camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau during the last years of World War II. Her entire family was murdered, except for her father, Morris, who died of tuberculosis shortly after liberation, and her brother, Frank, who was a partisan. Following liberation in May of 1945, Firestone was reunited with her brother and her soon-to-be husband, Bernard. She settled in Prague and completed her education in the Prague School of Commercial Arts. In 1948, Firestone immigrated to the United States with Bernard and their infant daughter, Claire. After arriving here, she pursued her love of fashion, becoming a noted designer. Renee has spoken all over the country, works closely with the Freedom Writers Foundation, and has been in several documentaries, including Swimming in Auschwitz. Her daughter, Claire, from Los Angeles, is a marriage and family therapist and an accomplished public speaker in her own right. She is the founder and current president of Second Generation Los Angeles, and she is with us this evening in the audience. Please welcome her. Renee and Claire join us as part of the museum's Scholars in Residence Education Series. The Scholars in Residence Series connects area students with impactful educational opportunities related to history and cultural diversity. Since its inception in 2009, approximately 30,000 students, teachers, and museum visitors have participated in this program. The overarching goal of the program is to promote academic achievement, cultural diversity, and a lifelong love and appreciation for history. Renee shared her story with approximately 500 seniors in high school at Omaha South yesterday, and will speak to another 600 eighth and ninth graders tomorrow at Gretna High School. We also want to thank the Institute on Holocaust Education, or the IHE. We are presenting this program tonight in partnership with them. IHE is a nonprofit Omaha-based organization serving Nebraska and the surrounding states. Its mission is to provide educational resources, workshops, survivor testimony, and integrated arts programming to students, educators, and the public. There are several members of the IHE board and their legacy donors with us this evening. We would like to welcome them. And we also know that in the audience we have some survivors that are here locally. So we would like to recognize them. Please join me in welcoming them. Now, I am honored and I am so delighted that I am able to introduce to you our guest, Ms. Renee Firestone.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Renee, and as you know, I'm a Holocaust survivor. And I will try to give you a little picture of what the experience was. But I would like to ask you a question. Why do you think, after 71 years of liberation, why do we still speak about the Holocaust? I am worried about the ones that are repeating it, that are still repeating it. That's why I'm here to tell my story. Because I have traveled, I have met survivors of Cambodia, I was recently in Rwanda, met survivors of Rwanda, and the stories I have heard from these people tells me that humanity learned absolutely nothing from the Holocaust. And what's going on in the world in general with the ISIS, killing the Christians now, whatever, you know, there's one thing I can absolutely not understand. How can people hate somebody they don't know? How can you hate somebody you have nothing, you never met, you don't know them, you don't know nothing about them? Can you love them? Can you hate them? How? How is that possible? And the reason I still travel and speak about the Holocaust, because I really see that the world really is in a very bad shape today. And I hope that especially some of the young people that I speak to in schools, that some of them will be the ones that will save the future. So I am very grateful to you to come to hear my story. I was born and raised in the most democratic country in Europe, in a country where we could not imagine anybody hating anybody. I was raised in Czechoslovakia. I don't know how much you know about Czechoslovakia, but also before World War I, Middle Europe was one country. It was called the Austro-Hungarian Monarchy. And after the war, after World War I, all these countries that spoke different languages, had different ideas, wanted to separate themselves. And so the borders were changing in Europe. And there were two Czech professors in Chicago, at the Chicago University. One was called Tomáš Masaryk. Anybody heard that name before? And the other one was Edvard Beneš. By the way, both of them became presidents of Czechoslovakia. But they were professors in Chicago, and they heard that the European borders are changing and that all these countries are separating themselves. So they decided they also want to have their own country. Tomáš Masaryk already had an American wife, of course. And with the help of the United States, they went back to Europe and created Czechoslovakia. Because of that, of course, they modeled it after Czechoslovakia, after the United States. And it was not only the most democratic, but also the most progressive country. It was the first country in Europe where you could buy ready-made clothes or ready-made shoes, which was unheard of before. And I was very lucky to be born in this country. Now, this country did have a big problem. And the problem was that the land was a little strip of land in the very heart of Europe, in the very center of Europe. It bordered on the west with Germany, ran all across the European countries, and bordered on the east with the Soviet Union at that time. Today, of course, it's the Ukraine. Can you imagine a country that borders with every country in Europe? With Poland, with Hungary, with Austria, with Germany, with Romania. All these countries were on our borders. So that itself made it quite unique. But as I said before, it was a creation of the United States. And I grew up very much like any American child would. We had all the fun at summertime, the swimming and playing tennis. At wintertime, of course, we were under the Carpathian Mountains, so we skied and skated. Just a wonderful childhood up to while I was 14 years old. And in the meantime, in 1933, a man appeared on the political scene, a man who nobody knew who he was, where he came from. They knew he was an Austrian, but nothing else much about him. And in 1933, he was elected Chancellor of Germany. And everybody was wondering, he's not a German, he's an Austrian. Why would they elect a man like that? And nobody, as I said, knew nothing about him. All of a sudden, we began to hear rumors that this man has a problem with the Jews, that he's obsessed with the Jewish people. And then we could hear all kinds of rumors that happened in Germany to the Jewish people, how the children can no longer go to school, how the parents' businesses were taken away, confiscated. And all these news were pretty scary, but, of course, we in Czechoslovakia couldn't even imagine that anything like that can happen in our country. So we were not worried, we were only wondering. Well, unfortunately, in 1938, we heard that in Berlin, the Jewish people were dragged out of their homes. They were humiliated, they were beaten, about 200 of them were murdered. And this event lasted 3 days. I'm sure you know, I'm talking about Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, where they destroyed everything in the Jewish homes and businesses. And after 3 days, they decided that the women and the children can go back into their destroyed homes, but not the men. And they gathered about 20,000 of Jewish men, and they were put into the first concentration camp, which was called Dachau, which is on the outskirts of a beautiful city of Munich. These men were never reunited with their families, of course, because these men slowly, systematically were murdered. And, of course, later, the women and the children were also killed. So this was in 1938. At the same time, in the same year, England noticed that Hitler is creating an army. He had these shows with his army in the theaters. They were showing them. And England began to worry. What does Hitler need an army for? The World War I just ended. Europe cannot afford another war. So why does he need the army for? And they decided to confront Hitler. So at the meeting, Mr. Chamberlain invited Mr. Daladier of France and Mussolini from Italy and Hitler, and they had a conversation. Why does Hitler need an army? Hitler's answer was that part of Czechoslovakia, which is bordering with Germany, a territory that is called the Sudetenland, used to belong to Germany, and he wants to occupy this territory, and he promises that if England and France allows him to occupy this territory, he will sign all peace treaties and Europe will be very safe of war. They did. They signed all the peace treaties. Hitler marched into the Sudetenland. But is that what he really wanted? Of course not. About 2 months later, his army marched into the capital of Czechoslovakia, which is the city of Prague, and wiped Czechoslovakia off the map. It wasn't that simple for him, though, because Czechoslovakia, as I said, was bordering with all the other countries with which he had no problem yet. So Hitler occupied the Czech Republic, Czech, Bohemia, Silesia, and Moravia, occupied and attached to Germany. Now he had problem with Slovakia, because Slovakia was bordering with Poland and with Hungary, and he had no problem with them yet. By the way, I want you to know that Hungary was actually the closest ally to Hitler, to Germany, because of the relationship from the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, of course. So Hitler occupies these three regions. Slovakia, he decides, let Slovakia become a separate country. And he gave them autonomy and put in a Nazi government. And there was a big problem there because the Slovaks hated the Nazis, but they also hated the Jews. So it was a real conflict there. And then there was one other region left, and that was the very eastern corner, which was bordering with Poland, with Hungary, and with the Soviet Union. And Hitler didn't know really what to do with this region, so he asked his closest ally, Hungary, take this region. And Hungary marched into our region, and overnight we became Hungarians. I was then 14 years old. Now I was worried, how am I going to go back to school? I didn't speak the Hungarian language. I went to Czech school, I spoke the Czech language. What am I going to do? And of course, my brother was even more worried because he was already in his graduating class, gymnasium. And we did not know, of course, that Hungary already had very similar anti-Jewish laws as Germany had the Nuremberg laws. We didn't know that. And so the Jewish teachers were all dismissed from the school system, from the Hungarian school system, and now these teachers were trying to earn a living. So they opened little workshops in their homes. And those Jewish parents who could pay her a little money would send their children to such a school. Now, I don't know whether you realize that in Europe, you go 5 years to elementary school, and then you go 8 years to gymnasium. And when you graduate gymnasium, it is as if you would go 2 years to junior college in the United States. That's a very important diploma there, because with a gymnasium diploma, you can enter almost any university. So my parents were very upset that my brother will not graduate. My brother was 5 years older than me. I had a little sister who was 4.5 years younger than myself. We lived in the capital of this Carpathian region. My father had a beautiful home there and a wonderful business. And I also must tell you that in 1937, my father had papers to come to the United States. He had a sister here in Los Angeles. And my mother refused to come. And by 1938, it was impossible to leave. So anyway, we found out that the Hungarian government decided that in this occupied territory, in the gymnasium, they will allow these six last graduating boys to graduate. And they will be the last Jews graduating from Hungarian gymnasium. And of course, my parents were delighted. This was wonderful news. But about 5 days before graduation, my brother doesn't come home from school. He disappears. And my parents are running around the neighborhood asking people, did anybody see him? Nobody. Nobody saw him. So my parents go back to school. Maybe the teacher, the principal knows something. They claim they don't know nothing. My father next day hires a non-Jewish lawyer to go to the government to find out what happened to his son. The lawyer comes back explaining that the six Jewish boys were removed from the classroom in front of the teacher and the principal, who claimed they knew nothing. They were taken to a nearby town where they are being interrogated because they are accused of being communists, producing flyers and newspaper, which, needless to say, nobody ever imagined such things. And the lawyer said that the government told him that if my parents would collect from the Jewish community in our town a certain amount of money, and of course they told him how much, the boys would be released. I remember that night very clearly because both my mother and father separately were running around to Jewish homes to collect the money. It took them about 2 days before they had the amount. And the lawyer went back with the money, came back telling us that my brother will come home. It took about 3 days before he showed up. He was bloodied, he was black and blue, he was beaten, he was tortured. But the Hungarian government did allow him to graduate. A few days after graduation, he received a notice from the government. The Hungarian government telling him that now he is of military age, but Hungary does not take Jews into the Hungarian military, and therefore every Jewish man of military age will have to enter a forced labor camp. Well, we know today somewhat what is a forced labor camp, but we never heard of forced labor camps before, so we had no idea. What is he going to be doing? Where is he going? Are we going to be able to see him or talk to him? Anyway, a few days later, my brother left. And after that, we knew nothing about him, where he was, what he was doing. And some of them were taken to the front because Hungary was already involved in, of course, in the war. And all of a sudden, which we didn't know, as I said, we didn't know that Hungary has these anti-Jewish laws, but now they reached us. And the very first things they took away from us, radio. That's right. They took away the radios. We didn't have television, but we did have radios. And that was the only communication we had because the non-Jewish population was threatened by the Hungarian government that if they would hide any Jews or help any Jews or befriend any Jews, they would be treated as Jews. So they didn't want to even talk to us or even smile at us on the street that somebody will report it as, you know, friendship. But they took away the radios. And now we were totally without any information what was going on in the world, and the world was on fire. Hitler was already occupying most of Western Europe, Holland, Belgium, Greece, all of Western Europe was already in German hands, which we didn't know, of course. We didn't know that the Jews were already removed from their homes and placed into ghettos and camps. We had never heard of such thing because we had no radios. And so in 1942, Hitler was already, as I said, had already Western Europe, and now he felt strong enough to invade the Soviet Union. We were worried that his next step will be east, which the first country was Hungary, that he's going to come to Hungary and occupy us. No, he was going to go for the Soviets. So the first he invaded Poland, of course, and occupied Poland, which we were now worried about. And then he ran into the Soviet Union, ran through the Ukraine without any problem. And by 1942, he was in White Russia on the borders of Stalingrad. And now we knew that the world, Europe, is gone, and who knows where he goes next. What we didn't know We didn't know that Napoleon, when he fought the Russians, he lost the war at the same place in front of Babia, in front of Stalingrad, when the winter came. And that the Russians were actually luring the German army to this territory, hoping that it's going to happen to the Germans. And that's exactly what happened. Winter came. The German army was not dressed for that climate. Their weapons didn't work in that climate. And the Russians were waiting for him and starting to push Hitler out of the Soviet Union. And Hitler now had major problems. And one of those problems was that when he was going into Russia, he was shooting Jews into mass graves. But in those same graves, he shot high-ranking Russian officers he captured. He shot them in these same graves. And now that he was being pushed out of the Soviet Union, he was worried that these graves will be discovered. And if they are discovered, he's going to be in trouble with the whole world, because it is international law not to shoot prisoners of war. So he was worried, and he told his whole army, as they were being pushed out of the Soviet Union, to stop wherever they find such a grave, and they should burn the bodies, rebury the ashes, don't leave such grave behind. But there was no time, because the Russians were really pushing fast. The largest of these graves was in the Ukraine, near the city of Kiev, called Babi Yar. In Babi Yar, 36,000 Jews were murdered within 3 days, and about 1,800 Soviets. So he was hoping that maybe his whole army can stop in Babi Yar. But again, there was no room. So Babi Yar today has 3 beautiful monuments for the grave. But now we were beginning to worry, because from the Ukraine going back to Germany, the German army has to pass our borders, the Hungarian borders. So now we figured, even though Hungary was his closest ally, he's in such trouble now that he won't care, and he will just occupy us also. The Hungarian army, the German army reached our borders, and Hitler found out that the Hungarian president, whose name was Nicholas Horthy, was already double-crossing him. Nicholas Horthy by now was the only country, Hungary was the only country where the Jews were still living at home. And Horthy was going to take advantage of that and began to negotiate with the Allies, trying to convince the Allies that he was not a partner to Hitler and that he had nothing to do with him. And his proof is that his Jews are still safe at home. Hitler is furious, needless to say, invites Horthy to Berlin and keeps him hostage while the German army marches into Hungary. And of course, at that point, we know we are doomed. Now, this is already 1944 April. And we know the Jewish people of Hungary are doomed, but we don't know about concentration camps. We only know about mass graves. So we all think that we're going to be shot into some mass graves. As soon as the German army marches into our city, the city is plastered with posters telling us that because the Hungarian Jews are still at home and in good physical condition, and the German army is now in trouble, these Jews will be taken to Germany to help out the German army. And what are we going to be doing? We are going to harvest, producing food for the army, or we are going to work in factories producing war machinery. Now I'm 20 years old. I go to my father asking him, what does he think? Can we trust the Germans? And my father explains to me that more than half of Germany is already occupied by the American and the English army. And the Russians are on our borders. So he says, honey, this war is over. Before we turn around, you know, I guarantee you, he says, in 4 months we're going to be back home. So we're going to work a little bit for them. Okay. They take us to the railroad station. They tell us we can take a little suitcase with us. They tell us the size of the suitcase and the weight of the suitcase. They take us to the railroad station. And, of course, going to Germany, we are looking for passenger trains. There are no passenger trains. Cattle cars are on the tracks, and they tell us we should pack in the cattle cars. Well, you know, the Jewish people amongst themselves are questioning, why are we traveling on cattle cars? I mean, we are going to help them out, help Germany out. At least they can take us on a regular train. And then some of them say, no, don't worry. It is because Hitler is in such trouble that he needs to now gather all his military from all over Europe, and so he needs all his trains. And that's why we have to travel on cattle cars. The Jewish people, they will agree about anything. And okay, so we pack into the cattle cars. The cattle car I was in, there were about 120 of us packed. No room to sit down, hardly room to put our little suitcases down. And I'm now 20 years old, in very good physical condition. I used to be a gymnast and an athlete, and I had a few colleagues in the cattle car with me. So we were going to take care of the old people. And we selected out all the old people and let them sit at the edges of the cattle cars so they can sit and lean against the cattle at the wall of the cattle car. We took children, babies, out of the arms of mothers and placed them into the laps of these elderly. And we were waiting. We noticed that in one of the corners of the cattle car is an empty bucket surrounded with a little bit of straw. So we figured out that must be for the bathroom for the old people, of course. And they didn't give us any food or any water, so this is going to be a very short journey wherever we're going. We also knew that from Hungary to Austria to Germany is maybe an 8-hour train ride. So between 7-8 hours, we're going to be at our destination. So it's not a big deal. The train lugs, they lug the train, and the train moves. Now we're traveling. We're traveling, it's 8 hours, 9 hours, 12 hours. The train is still going. Now it's getting dark, it's nighttime. All of a sudden, in the middle of the night, finally the train stops. The train stops, everybody's reaching for their suitcases. Finally, we're going to get off. Nobody gets off. The train, they are not opening the cattle cars. Instead, the Nazi soldiers that were escorting our train were banging on the walls of the cattle car, yelling to us that if we are hiding any money or any valuables, any jewelry, gold, silver, we should give it up now, or they say we will suffer very serious consequences. What do they want us to give up? When we were leaving our homes, there was a place where we had to deposit all our money and all our valuables, all our jewelry. So what do they think we have to give up? So people are talking to each other. This, all of a sudden, we hear shooting and screaming outside. And some people say, well, I bet some they are maybe searching people, and maybe somebody was hiding some of that stuff, and they were finding it, and that's why they are shooting them. And this is going on for quite a few hours. The children are begging their parents to take them home. They are crying. We don't see anything. It's in the middle of the night. And after a few hours, suddenly it gets quiet and the train moves. We traveled 3.5 days. And each night the train would stop and this looting and shooting would be going on. What we didn't know, that each night the train was in a different country in Europe, and the Jews were already packed in cattle cars, and all these cattle cars were attached to our train because we were all going to the same place. On the fourth day, the train stops, and through the cracks, I see it's daylight. So this is the first time the train stopped at daytime, so maybe finally we arrived to our destination. Sure enough, we can hear latches being opened, outside somebody screaming, "Heraus, heraus, out." Where are we? What are we going to do here? The cattle car opens, and I grab my little sister's hand. She was 16 years old. And I said to her, "We don't know where we are. We don't know what we are going to be doing here, how many people there are. So I tell you, never let go of my hand. We must stay together." And she starts crying and she says, "Okay." And we jump off the cattle car. When I jump off the cattle car and I look around to try to orient myself, I see that this train we arrived on doesn't have an end. And thousands of people are pouring out of this train. And the Nazi soldiers are yelling at everybody. And on the loudspeakers, they are yelling to us that we should leave our suitcases at the railroad station. Everything will be delivered to us. And we should obey orders and follow directions, because now we're going to be taken to a bathhouse. We're going to take a shower to refresh ourselves after this long journey. And then we will immediately be assigned to our work. Well, what I hear sounds reasonable, but what I see doesn't make any sense. I see Nazi soldiers marching up and down the railroad tracks, holding on to vicious dogs, teasing the dogs at the people pouring out of the cattle cars. And the people are screaming, crying, begging to be spared, and the dogs are barking, growling, biting. It's terror, absolutely terror. And some of us are being pushed towards the bathhouse. And as we are being pushed, my sister starts crying. She wants to find mother and dad. And of course, mother and dad disappeared in the crowd, so how am I going to ever find them? So now I'm telling her not to worry. When we get in where they are going to take us, we will find them there. And as we are being pushed, I suddenly notice that we are on the outskirts, on the railroad tracks, of a village which is surrounded with barbed wires. And in this village, I see rows and rows of wooden barracks as far as the eye could see. And each row of barracks is divided with a row of barbed wire. And I think to myself, that's a funny way to build villages. But, you know, the Nazis, the soldiers, the Germans, they do their way. And maybe that's the way they live. But then all of a sudden, I see some human skeletons walking around in this village in a gray striped pajama, which reminds me of prisoners' uniforms. So now I say to myself, no, maybe this is some kind of a prison. But they didn't tell me I'm going to be working in a prison, so what kind of work am I going to be doing here? And of course, all the stuff that I don't know is in my head. And I'm now wondering, what kind of work am I going to do in a prison? And I think maybe I'm going to be cooking, or who knows what. And as we are being pushed, all of a sudden I see that in the middle of the railroad tracks stands a Nazi officer. And when people come in front of him, he looks them over, and he separates them. He sends some people to the right of the railroad tracks, some to the left, others in other directions. Again, I'm trying to figure out, what does that mean? I don't know which way he sent my parents, because I never found my parents in the crowd. Is he going to take my sister away from me? So now I'm really scared. I don't know where I am, what's going to happen, what kind of work am I going to be doing. My sister and I come in front of him. He takes one look at me and he points me to the right of the railroad tracks. And I look over my shoulder to see where I'm supposed to go. And I see that he directs me to a big crowd of young, healthy women. And I look over and I see these are all young women, so I am going to the right group, but why? And I think to myself, maybe it's because they are separating the people according to what kind of work they are going to be doing. And here maybe they need young women for the kind of work we're going to be doing. And I'm It's okay with me. So I'm moving. As soon as I move, he stops my sister. So I stop again. And now he looks at me, looks at her. I am 20 years old. I'm in very good physical condition. I also happen to have long blonde hair and blue eyes. So he had no problem with me. My 16-year-old sister looks totally different from me. She's skinny, tall, a brunette, very dark brown hair, piercing black eyes, totally looks different. And now he keeps looking at her, looking at me, and then he taps me on the shoulder again and yells to me, "You go." And I yell to my sister in Hungarian, "Run." And the two of us start running towards the group I'm supposed to join. And he lets us go. So now I know everything is going to be just fine. We're going to be working together. He let my sister go with me. We're going to be together. Everything is going to be okay. Of course, I have no idea where I am. As I am approaching the group, they are yelling back at me how lucky I am that I wasn't shot. Why would I be shot? And something about a Mengele. Mengele and I should be shot. What are they talking about? I have no idea. Of course, later I find out that this man who separated the people at the railroad station meets every transport, and right there at the railroad station, he decides who is going to live another day or another week or whatever, but who is going to die immediately. Now, how would I know who this man is? And we are standing with this group. Now I'm watching how they are separating the people. But again, I still don't know who Mengele is. I still don't know where I am. And I see, as we are standing there watching, we see that he sends all the old people to the left of the railroad station, at the railroad tracks. And who are the old people? Well, anybody who has a white hair is an old people. So anybody who has a little gray hair went to the left. And I also see that he sends to the left all the children, from infants to about 14, 15 years of age. All the children go to the left. Again, in my head, I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. And I have reason for everything. So if all the young people are going to go to work, somebody has to take care of the children. So that's why the old people are going with the children. Logic? But I didn't know that also I saw my mother going that way, that by the time we walked to the bathhouse where we were gonna take the shower, my mother and all the old and young children were already gassed. We still watched how they were putting them on military trucks, and I was even happy about it because they told us that we are going to walk about a mile and a half to the bathhouse, and I thought to myself, it's good for my mother, she won't have to walk. But did I know that she's not going to be alive by the time I reached the bathhouse? And so we walked into an underground dressing room where they tell us we should get undressed, but we should fold our belongings very neatly. We should tie our shoes together. They shouldn't separate. We should remember exactly where our stuff is, because when we come out of the shower, we will have to dress immediately to be assigned to our work. Well, we walk into the shower room. We take a 1 minute ice cold shower, and then we are pushed out on the other side of the shower room into a clearing where the Nazi soldiers with the dogs are waiting for us. We are naked, wet. It's late afternoon. It's getting dark. The dogs are barking, biting, growling. The people are screaming, crying. We will be all killed here. But the crowd is huge. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, a Nazi officer shows up and picks about 1,000 of us and pushes us out and into one of these wooden barracks. Now we are standing, about 1,000 women in line, and those of us in the back are wondering what is going on up front. We are hoping that maybe they are giving us a little food or maybe a little water. Now this is 4 days without food or water. So we're hoping that that's what they are doing in the front. And now we're coming closer. We see that they are shaving the heads and the bodies of the women. And then there is a pile of clothing, and they tell us to pick one of these dresses and put it on our naked bodies. And that's how they take us into the campsite. No food, no water. And we are standing outdoors. People are crying, talking to each other, figuring out where are we, what happened to us just now. Why did we have to get undressed and they took all our clothing away? What is this place about? We have absolutely no idea, of course. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, out of 4 brick chimneys, which were in the 4 corners of the camp, fire, smoke starts shooting to the sky, chimneys that we didn't see in the dark. What is this fire? The fire is burning. The sky becomes red. We are in hell. We are all going to be burned here. It's not the dogs that are going to kill us. This fire is going to kill us. And people start crying, screaming. All of a sudden, ashes falling all over. White ashes like snow. What's going on here? Where are we? Nobody knows. Everybody's talking, crying, screaming. All of a sudden, one prisoner yells, "Don't panic! Look at those chimneys! Those must be the factories we're going to be working at. So don't be scared. Everything will be okay." Now people start talking again, of course, talking to each other, hoping Maybe she's right. Maybe those are factories. Maybe we will survive. And this is going on, of course, till daybreak comes. And all of a sudden, at daybreak, some overseers show up. We call them capos. And the capos come, and they are holding clubs like a baseball bat. And they come over, and without talking to us or telling us who they are or what they want, they start beating us. And they are beating and pushing and shoving. And this is from daybreak. Now it's getting dark already, and they are still beating us and pushing us. We don't know why. They are yelling something in German, which sounds like Zehr Appell. Those of us who speak German never heard the expression. What is Zehr Appell? Nobody knows. And we don't know why they are doing this to us. All of a sudden, it's getting dark. And I see now that in front of us lie some of people that were beaten to death. Some of them, the capos come and put blankets over them. Some of them are still moving, but not able to get up anymore. And I'm looking around. My sister is standing next to me, and I realize now what they are doing is they are pushing us into these long lines of columns of five. And my sister standing next to me starts crying, and she starts begging me, I should find out when are we going to be reunited with our parents. How am I going to find out? Who am I going to ask? The people, the prisoners, don't know it, just like I don't know it. So the only one I could ask was the capos. But would I dare walk out of this line now to find out, to ask them anything, with the clubs in their hands? And I'm looking around. One of the prisoners next to me says to me, whispers to me, do you know why they lined up here? I said, no. Why, do you? He says, sure. He says, now they are going to bring the machine guns and they are going to finish us off. And I said, are you sure? He says, for sure. So I think to myself, well, if that's the truth, then why am I afraid to walk over to the capo and ask her anything I want to know? And I, heartbeat, scared, step out of the line, walk over to one of them, and very politely, I ask her, does she know when are we going to be reunited with our parents? She points to one of the chimneys, and she yells at me, you don't see the chimney and the fire and the smoke? There go your parents. My parents go through the chimneys. What does that mean? How could anybody coming from the outside world knowing where the hell are we and what is going on here, that we are in hell, how would I know that? So I start turning around, coming back to my sister, and she yells after me, don't worry, when you go through the chimneys, you will be reunited. I'm going to go through the chimneys. What does that mean? Again, I think she's crazy. So I come back to my sister and I say to her, I have no idea. We will find out later. All of a sudden, Dr. Mengele shows up. He walks by the line with his finger. He points at some people. He calls them out, heraus! To follow him, they walk away, and now the capos are yelling, dismissed. The whole group is dismissed. What does it mean, dismissed? Are we going to live somewhere? Are they going to take us somewhere to sleep or give us some food? And of course, nothing is happening. So I grabbed my sister's hand and I said, let's go and let's find out some of those people who have the striped uniforms. They will tell us who we are and what is this place about. And sure enough, I see three girls standing there, and I approach them very carefully, and I ask them, do they know what it means that I'm going to go through the chimneys? And one of them says to me, honey, where do you think you are? And I said, oh, I know where we are. We came to Germany to help out the German army. And she says, oh, no, you are in Poland. You are in the largest extermination camp called Auschwitz-Birkenau. Never heard of it. Auschwitz-Birkenau? And what am I going to exterminate? What is an extermination camp? Well, needless to say that I had no idea where I am, what's going on. And it took us quite a few days, weeks, before we really found out where we are and what Auschwitz-Birkenau really is. And you know, sitting here 71 years later, I keep asking myself, why am I here? Why me? Why did I escape all this? Why did I escape the chimneys? Why did I escape the war? Why did I live this long? Why am I here? And because I don't have an answer, of course, and I don't have any ideas, why not my 16-year-old sister? Why didn't she survive? I keep saying to myself, maybe telling my story, maybe reminding the world of what can happen if we still start killing each other, hating each other, not respecting one another. Maybe that's why I'm still here. Maybe that's why I survived. And that's why I come and tell you my story. I could be sitting here till tomorrow morning telling you stories. But basically, I am surprised at myself that I'm still capable to tell the story, and as I say, that I'm still able to even talk or walk. And that's the reason why I still travel and tell you a little bit about my story. So I thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Renee Firestone. She has given her recollections of being imprisoned at age 19 for 13 months in the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp during the last years of World War II. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, May 3, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.